He's not as smart as David Iverson. He's not nearly as distinguished as Ken Pendergraft. And he's way shorter than Tom Kelly. But every family needs a black sheep with special skills and abilities. Are you ready to just blame Joey?
And it is time once again for a little bit of Just Blame Joey Live, coming to you from the 1776 Audio Foundry Studios this morning. Got a special treat for you. Representative Harriet Hageman was in Carbon County last night, and I happened to be present recording the whole time. So we're just going to go ahead and hear what Harriet had to say. And I got to tell you, the audience was pretty quiet, so you won't hear them asking their questions. I will jump in and let you know what the questions are in between the responses from the good representative from the state of Wyoming. And with that, we won't waste another moment so we can get to all the commentary from Harriet Hageman right here on the Independence Network.
After an exclusive two-decade tour of Europe, Asia, the Pacific, the Middle East, and all stops in between, realizing Wyoming is the only America that America has left, he's finally back for good. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is the distinct pleasure of 1776 Audio Foundry Management to present to you your host, recently profiled on the lifestyles of the prolific and gifted. He's an overnight success that has been years in the making. He's your very own Saratoga Sledgehammer. Here is Jailbird Joey.
Well, hello and thank you for engaging once again in another opportunity to get your fill of cantankerous commentary and political entertainment all backed up with actual facts and data. Coming to you from the Cathedral of Accountability in a well-secured bunker deep beneath the 1776 Audio Foundry Studios, this is the home of liberty-minded constitutional conservatism. I am your host, the Saratoga Sledgehammer, Mr. Misdemeanor himself, Jailbird Joey, and it is time to just blame Joey. Good day to you, all you biological boys and girls. And if you identify as anything else, this show is most likely not going to be your cup of tea. But we're going to get started anyway, and you're more than welcome to stick around and give it a listen. And I wish you the best of luck with those feelings as you just blame Joey. So with that, let's stir this pot.
Thank you. Is that too loud? Is that okay? You can all hear me all right? Well, wonderful. How are you? It's so good to see some of you, and I know that some of you have driven quite a ways to be here from Saratoga and other areas, perhaps encampment. It's wonderful to be back in Rawlins. I know I've probably said this before when I've been here, but I used to live in this county. I used to work highway construction, and one summer I lived down the third floor of the Wolf Hotel for a couple of weeks, and then I lived at Walcott Junction in the truck stop. We had a fifth wheel trailer out there, and there's not many people, not even here, who can claim that they actually lived at Walcott Junction. One of the things that I remember is that you could see the storms coming in from so far away, and you could see the lightning and the skies in the way, because everything's rather flat out there. But it was just, I just remember how incredibly beautiful it was to see things as they changed, and the sunsets and the sunrises. And we paved the highway from I-80 all the way to Hanna, worked with a great group of people. But every time I drive by there, I think about that summer. They did have, the restaurant was there, and they had the bar and the pool table. So I was able to hone my skills at pool, making me more marketable as I got older. You know, I want to thank you all for coming this evening. I know that you do have to travel. You've got a lot of other things to do. I have enjoyed the last 15 months being in office, and when I ran for Congress, I promised that I would come back to every county every year and do at least one town hall. Now, I travel through the counties, and I have other meetings, and I meet with county commissioners, and I meet with local groups, and so I'm in the counties for other things, but I think that town halls are kind of a unique and special way of interacting with the folks that I represent. I don't know how I can represent you unless I'm here engaged in talking to you, so that I can talk to you about what I've been doing, but even more importantly, so that I can hear your thoughts about what I'm doing and what issues are important to you. So what I typically do is I'm going to give you kind of a summary of where we are, especially over just the last couple of weeks, what's gone on in Washington, D.C., and then I'm going to open up for questions and just engage in a dialogue with you. I see you kind of shaking your head, and that's exactly how I feel right now as well. The last couple of weeks have been pretty rough. They've been pretty rough. If you believe in our Constitution and you believe in limited government, you believe that the people out here are going to make a lot better decisions for themselves than folks in Washington, D.C. And for those of us who believe in fiscal responsibility and recognize that $34 trillion in debt is unsustainable, the last couple of weeks have been pretty rough. I'm just going to go over a few of the things that we've done recently. I'm going to talk to you about some of the bills that I have been working on behalf of the folks of Wyoming. And then again, you can talk to me about what's important to you. On March 22nd, the House passed the second minibus bill, which funded the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, State, and more. That bill was 1,102 pages long, and it cost $1.2 trillion. Yet we were only given 32 hours to read it. I opposed this irresponsible spending and the bad process. So far, I have voted against every continuing resolution, and I voted against both minibuses. We're spending money that we don't have on policies that we don't want, and we are engaging in really bad government. And we're going to have to change the trajectory of this country, and people are going to have to make difficult decisions. That should start with us, but for some reason it doesn't. On April 8th, the first bill that I introduced as chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian Insular Affairs. So I'm the chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian and Insular Affairs. I'm on the Natural Resource Committee and the Judiciary Committee. And with Natural Resources, I'm the chairman of that subcommittee, which is fairly unusual for a freshman. But with my background and the work that I've done, Chairman Westerman thought that that would actually be a really good fit. And I have enjoyed the work that I have been able to do there. I oversee our 574 federally recognized tribes. And then I also oversee our engagement with our five territories. And then this last year, we were also working on what's called the COFA agreements, the Compact of Free Association. And I actually went down to the South Pacific, and we had some hearings down there working on arrangements with Palau, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. The United States has been entering into 20-year agreements with those three island chains, essentially so that we can control all shipping lanes and shipping traffic in the Pacific Ocean because of the arrangement that we have with those and where they're located. These are three extremely important islands in terms of making sure that we can fight back against Russia and stop Russia from engaging in some of the bad acts that they, or not Russia, excuse me, China, some of the bad acts that they've been doing, especially with their overfishing. China is notorious for their illegal overfishing, and they are just trying to denude the oceans. So that's one of the ways by working with these three island chains, we actually are having some success in pushing back on China. But one of the very first bills that I introduced is when I got into Congress, I found out that our Indian tribes are limited to leasing their property to 25 years. Now, you all who own real property in here, you have the right to enter into long-term lease arrangements. But one of the things that this is, I think, an example of the paternalism that we have over our tribes and our refusal to recognize, number one, their autonomy, but number two, they're also responsible for themselves. And I believe that the key to prosperity in this country, and our forefathers believed it as well, and that is the ownership and control of real property. And so they are limited to 25 years, but it makes it very difficult for them to engage in economic development because people aren't necessarily going to bring in a convenience store or a movie theater or a grocery store because they don't want just a 25-year lease. So one of the very first bills that I ever introduced was to increase that to 99 years. Now, there have been circumstances where a tribe could go to the Secretary of Interior and seek special permission on a particular contract. One of the tribes that came and testified in front of us, and I think this is an example of our broken government, they had had two petitions pending in front of the Secretary of Interior to increase that 25-year lease limit on two different parcels of land that they own. One of those petitions had been pending for 14 years, and the other one had been pending for 22 years. And I just think that that kind of a bureaucracy is a disaster. It's uncalled for, and we need to change the way we're doing business if we're going to make sure that we can have success on our reservations. So that I introduced the bill to extend that to 99 years. We had a markup in committee. We passed it out of our committee. And then last week, we passed it out of the House of Representatives. So it's headed over to the Senate. I'm really pretty proud of that piece of legislation because I think it will really help tribes across the country to be able to do more in terms of economic development. On April 12th, the House passed the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. It is a bill reauthorizing Section 702 of FISA, which is set to expire, was set to expire on April 19th. I'm a member of the House Judiciary Committee, as I said, and we had tried to reform, scale back, and sunset FISA through a variety of policies such as warrant requirements, yet those priorities were rejected and they actually expanded FISA when it was brought to the floor. So I have opposed. I voted against the FISA reauthorization. FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, foreign being the operative word, but our intelligence agencies and our law enforcement agencies have been using and abusing FISA to spy on American citizens. Just as an example, in 1 year, they had over 3 million illegal searches of American citizens. And then they scaled that back to 287,000 illegal searches on American citizens, meaning any one of you could have been the target of that. I am a strong constitutionalist. I believe that our Constitution says what it means and means what it says when it comes to the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the First Amendment. And so the Judiciary Committee, we actually did a beautiful job with FISA reform and making sure that there were some strictures on our intelligence agencies so that we could protect your civil liberties. But the intelligence community fought hard and our leadership went with the intelligence community instead. And they've actually now expanded FISA. That's not the end of the discussion. We're going to continue fighting this because one of the things that we did get in there is instead of a five-year reauthorization, we've only reauthorized it for 2 years. So we're going to continue with this battle because I don't think that the federal government ought to be spying on you. And if they want information about you, they ought to get a warrant. So that's something we'll continue to fight on. On April 16th, I had the immense honor of delivering the articles of impeachment on Secretary Mayorkas to the Senate as one of the 11 impeachment managers. Unfortunately, the Senate broke with 230 years of American history, and they dismissed the articles before trial, refusing to allow us to even do an opening statement or present any of the evidence that we had. I have a notebook that is about this thick, a three-ring binder, and there are five reports in there of the investigation that the Homeland Security Committee has done over the last year in exposing Mayorkas for the things that he has done. And I can assure you it was a very legitimate impeachment in the House of Representatives, and if there was any integrity in the Senate, he would have been convicted and removed from office. We have over 11 million illegal aliens that have come into our country in the last 3 years. We have an agency. This last week, I had a visit. I had the Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security, an independent investigator, reached out to me and has given me some very important information about what the Department of Homeland Security has done. And I asked him, why have you contacted me? Are you contacting everybody in the House to ask for assistance? And he said, no. I'm only contacting a couple of you because I think there's only a couple of you who are willing to actually expose this and fight it because it is so bad. The Department of Homeland Security has lost over 85,000 children in the last 3 years that they are unable to identify and locate where they are. We do know that they are working in meatpacking plants. We know that they are working in New York City. We also know that they are engaging in child trafficking, sex trafficking, those sorts of things. So one of the issues that they are now engaging in is that they are giving 10 to 15 children at a time to people who are showing up at where we're keeping the children, where Department of Homeland Security and Border Security, where they first take the children when they're coming across the border. They are having people come in vans and they are giving them 10 to 15 children at a time. They're no longer DNA testing them and they are not requiring them to say that they are actually family members. So your federal government, in order to try to cover up the absolute unbelievable crisis on our southern border, is actually engaging in child trafficking at this point. The other thing that he told me that I found to be completely fascinating and shocking was that when you hear about the app on the phone, if you want to apply for asylum, you can fill out information on your phone. There's an app that the DHS has sent out to all of these folks so that they can readily apply for asylum. And he said, have you ever done a reservation on OpenTable for like a restaurant reservation for dinner? That's what this app is. This app is similar to an OpenTable app where you go and fill out your information, put in your contact information, and you can apply for asylum that way. That's what they're doing right now in order to try to process these people into the country as quickly as they can. So I am very proud of the fact that we impeached Mayorkas. I'm very disappointed in the fact that we were unable to have the trial so that the American people could understand what he has done. Now, one thing that happened that was really, really good last week, and I'm also very proud of, is that we passed, and this came out of the Judiciary Committee again, but we passed what's called the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act. And that is a bill which defends privacy by closing a loophole the FBI is using to surveil Americans without a warrant. So what the FBI and these other intelligence agencies have been doing is actually buying all of your data. So when you pull out your phone and it'll have your location, it shows what websites you've visited, what you may have purchased online, who you have called. They cannot, the FBI and our law enforcement agencies are not allowed to get that information directly from the cell phone providers, but they can buy it. So what's been created is data brokers. And so these agencies are going to data brokers and purchasing this information. They can geolocate you within one yard. They can geolocate you. We have been working for a while to stop that. We tried to get that in the FISA bill, but leadership fought us on that. Last week, I led the debate on the floor of the House of Representatives, and we actually got that passed in the House of Representatives. So I don't know what the Senate will do with it. I am hoping that they will bring it up because there are several Democrats that are also in support of that bill. So we might actually be able to get that to the president's desk. He may very well veto it, but I think it's extremely important because the IRS, FBI, NSA, all of these various federal agencies are using that data to know where you are at any one time and claiming that they don't have to get a warrant because they can buy it. So this just on Saturday, we voted to consider the Senate Foreign Aid Supplement, a bill that the House Republicans rejected. But then we were forced to vote on it. I think we had maybe 30 or 35 hours. It was well over 1,000 pages long. It cost $95 billion. We have now outspent the Pelosi COVID levels by $32 billion and counting. We have sent $61 billion to Ukraine with no accountability whatsoever. No idea of what the ultimate outcome of this war is, what it is, how do we know when we're victorious or not? I was reading on the way here that the new claim is, even though this was only 3 days ago that we voted on this, it was now too little too late and we're going to need to be sending more. Our demand in the House was that we had to have border security or we were not going to give any money to Ukraine. In this bill, there is $300 million for the border security of Ukraine and for drug interdiction, but none for our border. We did the Israel bill. There was $28 billion there. There's $9.2 billion in humanitarian aid for the Middle East. That $9.2 billion is for Hamas. Let that sink in for what our leadership just did to us. There was, I think, $14 billion for Taiwan, but the president can reclaw that back and give it to Ukraine as well. So the obsession in Washington, D.C. with Ukraine has been so far inexplicable to me. No one has been fully able to explain to me what it is, why we are sending this kind of money to one of the most corrupt nations on earth. I am not supportive of what Russia did. I don't like Russia and I don't like Putin. The only thing anybody's been able to tell me is if we don't stop him in Ukraine, he's going to invade Europe. And my response is then maybe Europe ought to be putting up some cash for their defense. So I was visiting with a reporter from England last week and she was almost hysterical when she said, would you support this $61 billion for Ukraine? And I said, absolutely, I will not. That is not what the people in Wyoming want. In all of the thousands of people that I have talked to in the last 15 months, and maybe there's some Ukraine supporters in here, and we can have the discussion, but in 15 months, I've had one person talk to me about the importance of sending whatever it takes to Ukraine, one out of all the thousands. I said, that is not what Wyoming wants. Wyoming has different priorities. And she said, but he's going to invade Europe. And I wanted to say, well, then why aren't they putting up the money? Because right now we have exposed that our NATO countries have been cooking the books, and they have not put up the cash, even the amount that they say they do, that they have, which is less than what they're required to. So now it's been exposed that they're not even putting up the amount of money that they said that they would, with us putting up $61 billion. So one of the other things, and there's been a lot of discussion about this in Wyoming, is what's going on with our postal service. And again, this is an example of us focusing so much on other countries. The money that we're sending to Ukraine, so far less than 50% has made it to the front lines. We're paying for their trash collection. We're paying for their pensions. We're paying for their schools. We're paying for their government. We are right now funding a lot of the government in Ukraine. They're shutting down our post offices in the United States and our distribution centers because of the challenges associated with funding. So Senator Lummis Barrasso and I just introduced what's called the Postal Act, and it would prevent the post office from being able to close down our last distribution center in the state of Wyoming. It would make it so that every state had at least one distribution center. As they are trying to close down our distribution center, it's going to affect our ability to get medication to our veterans. Voting, it's going to have a huge impact on voting because we're looking at least a 10-day delay with the mail in the southern part of the state going to Denver, eastern or western side going to Salt Lake, northern going to Billings. So they're going to have to take and process our mail up there and then bring it back. So it's going to be as much as a 10 to 15 day delay for us to get our mail, which is going to be devastating in terms for those folks who get their medication, their packages, and again, the voting is going to have an impact. So again, I think that the Postal Act actually has some bipartisan support. One other thing that I did is on April 16th, the Natural Resources Committee passed my bill reforming the BLM abuse of the expression of interest fees. Under this bill, operators will not have to pay those EIO fees unless the BLM actually holds a lease. So right now, if you're an oil and gas producer and you want to identify certain acreage for development, you have to pay $5 an acre for that to the BLM. But they may never process that lease, and then you lose that money. It can be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars for our producers. And then they also reduced it so that it was only you could only do that for 3 years, and then you had to renew. And then they are not processing the applications. So I have introduced a bill that they do not get the money until they actually process the application to make sure that they're not withholding millions of dollars from our oil and gas producers. Those are just some of the things that I've been working on. Backcountry Aviation Protection Act, we've had some really bizarre things coming out of the FAA, and for our bush pilots and our people out here who are checking cows and sheep and things like that, they were starting to go after some of them because if you have to go down and do a pass to see if there's a safe place to land, that actually violates one of their regulations, even though it is also what you're supposed to do pursuant to another regulation. So I introduced the Backcountry Aviation Protection Act that it would protect our pilots so that they could actually go in for safe landings. I've done quite a few. The Energy Poverty Prevention and Accountability Act of 2023, that's a bill that I introduced, passed by the Natural Resource Committee. Every time I have anyone from the BLM or the Department of Interior or Forest Service or any of those agencies in front of me, I ask them, why is it that every policy you pursue ends in energy poverty? Why is it that you're such strong advocates for energy poverty? Why do you want the American citizens to suffer, and why do you think that's your role? And so I introduced a bill that requires them, for any one of the regulations they introduce, they have to actually guarantee that it will not result in energy poverty. And what I'm trying to do is force them to disclose the real cost of their regulations, whether it is the EPA or these various land agencies, when they refuse to, process coal permits or oil and gas permits. I'm just trying to force them out into the open as to what the real costs are. Country of Origin Labeling Enforcement Act, that's so that we know where our beef and our meat comes from. It ought to be that if it is not American beef, it shouldn't have an American label on it. And so I've introduced the MCOOL, the Mandatory Country of Origin Labeling Bill. Uranium Miners and Workers Act, it would amend the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, to provide additional funds to our uranium miners to try to address some of the health challenges that they've had since working in the uranium industry. Coal Act, Power Act, just a variety of things that I've done, really focused on the issues that I think are important in Wyoming. I have fought back hard against the BLM's RMP for the Rock Springs District. I fought hard back against Rocky Mountain Power and their efforts last year to increase our electricity rates by 30%, because so much of that is related to bad policy, bad federal policy. So those are just some of the things that we've been working on. I think probably the best thing now would be to turn to questions and comments and ideas and thoughts and guidance and instructions and whatever else you want to give me. So do we have any questions in the room?
And the first question from the audience, Harriet, what would you do about Speaker Johnson? Could he be removed as well? And what would happen there?
I think the Democrats would save him. So that's the problem with it. What happened last year was really a tragedy. And I'll tell you why I say that. And I've had some blowback from people because of my support for Speaker McCarthy. But Kevin McCarthy got some very conservative legislation through. H.R. 1, the very best energy security bill that they've been working on for about 5 years. That went through under Kevin McCarthy. H.R. 2, the very best border security bill in U.S. history. That went through under Speaker McCarthy. H.R. 5, the Parents' Bill of Rights bill to make sure that our parents can be fully engaged with their children's education and we can stop some of this nonsense that's been going on in our schools. I had quite a few priorities that I was able to get through under Speaker McCarthy. And when they did the motion to vacate, it threw us in disarray for 3 weeks, because under our Constitution, if you do not have a speaker, there's no other business that can be conducted. We simply cannot go through another 3 week situation where we're not able to hold hearings, or I don't know what's going to happen on the legislative front, but it did not reflect well on anybody. And I think that we're in the hangover from that. I think we're suffering the consequences from it. And as far as the motion to vacate, the Democrats have signaled that they would vote in his favor. And if that's the case, I don't believe that there are enough votes to vacate him. And then the question becomes, even if we did, who's the next speaker? And it's not me. I'm kidding.
Our next question for the good Congresswoman, what is Congress doing about censorship on social media and non-traditional media like The Blaze and OAN?
We'll look into that. We will definitely look into that. One of the things that has been exposed, while I actually think that the 118th Congress has been a lot more successful than I think people realize when you just look at the legislative side of things, we have been able to expose more in the 118th in terms of what have been going on with our intelligence agencies, our law enforcement agencies, but also the insidious relationship between this White House and the various social media and regular media companies. And there's a case before the United States Supreme Court right now that is going to determine whether the federal government has the right to do indirectly what it cannot do directly. And by that, whether they can use a third party to censor those voices that they don't want heard. And so I think depending on whether the White House was involved at all with what happened with AON, I think that the decision from the United States Supreme Court may be helpful in that regard. So we anticipate that decision will be out within the next 6 weeks. And I am hoping that the Supreme Court will do the right thing and say that the White House does not have the ability. We found out through the Select Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government that there were over 170 agencies that had direct backdoor ties to Facebook and Google and YouTube and all of these social media companies. And they were instructing them on a daily basis of which posts, which addresses, which IP addresses to take down, which is pure unadulterated censorship. It could be jokes about the president or the president's wife. Even the office of the First Lady of the United States was contacting these social media companies and demanding that they take down posts that were critical of the First Lady. Well, we have a First Amendment. You can't do that. And so that's the specific issue that is before the Supreme Court. We'll see it. I'll look into the extent to which the White House was associated with the AON decision. But that actually may be something that the Supreme Court is going to address. It is pretty crazy right now where we are. What we see on the university campuses back east, I would imagine for all of those about my age and here or older, none of us ever would have expected in a million years we would be seeing these kinds of things play out in our cities and on our university campuses. It's pretty frightening what's happening, and it's doubly frightening that our leaders do not have the moral compass to condemn it and call it out for what it is. But that's where I have been exposed to an awful lot of how our government has really transmogrified from an open republic based upon the Bill of Rights and constitutional order and the rule of law into almost a third world country in our approach to the favored few, and looking at the trial that's going on in New York with President Trump. As a trial attorney, regardless of my political affiliation, regardless of my support for President Trump, there are things going on in that trial that are so absolutely contrary to regular order and procedure that is probably as frightening to me as anything else. There were two jurors that had already been seated on that jury, and the judge went in day before yesterday or late last week and removed those two jurors. One of them had said when he was asked during the voir dire, he said, the question was, what do you think of President Trump? And he said, I think I find him intriguing. I find him intriguing, but nothing more than that. The judge unilaterally, without either party requesting it, the judge unilaterally removed that juror. And they also removed a woman who was going to be more pro-Trump. So watching that judge, the gag orders that he is imposing against President Trump while allowing everyone else to speak, when we go into trial, you usually will divide your time about equally between your prosecution and your defense, your plaintiffs and your defendants, and that's due process. You really have to do that. Sometimes a judge will say, we have 126 hours to try this case. We're going to do 4 hours for whatever motions, and then each of you, you get, what would it be? 61 hours each to try a case over a two-week period. That's what you get, and you can use it any way you want to, but that's it. This judge has allowed the prosecution to take whatever time they want. When the defense attorney gets up, he says, you've got 15 minutes. You got to finish right now. You've got three questions. That's all you're going to get. I mean, I've never seen such blatant violations of the rules of civil procedure and due process as I'm watching in New York. And what that tells me is that the judge knows he's going to get overturned. If Trump is convicted, he knows he's going to get overturned. But that won't happen until after the election. So it doesn't matter to them right now. The sole purpose of this is to get the conviction. It'll get overturned. The one with Letitia James, the $450 million fine, that's not going to stand up. It's not even possible to stand up. The judge wouldn't allow any evidence in the case that was supportive of President Trump. It's not going to survive appeal. But in the meantime, they took all of his money away. So it's those kinds of things, that kind of lawfare, that for me is really kind of frightening in terms of where we are in this country right now.
Third question for the good representative. Could you explain what the president is doing with all this loan repayment stuff? The Supreme Court shut that down, I believe, but he's coming around and trying to do it all over again.
Well, so one of the things that I think that when you study history and you study the Constitution and you study things like the Federalist Papers and how we ended up with the kind of country that we have, with the foundation and framework that we have, we're the country with the longest living constitution in the history of the world, almost 250 years. And you look at what our forefathers did in terms of identifying the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch. You look at the fact that the states would not ratify the Constitution until the Bill of Rights was put in place. And our Bill of Rights is a set of negative rights. It doesn't say that I have the right to freedom of speech. It says the government shall not infringe upon my right to freedom of speech, because my rights come from God. They don't come from the government. That was absolutely unheard of at the time that they created this constitution. But there's one hole. They expected that our leaders, our political leaders, would be, and they wrote a constitution for a just and moral people. And when you devolve into where you are no longer a just and moral person or people, they didn't write something in the Constitution to prevent the kinds of things that we're seeing today. That's the one hole that I see, because they never expected that people would do what we're seeing happen in this country, because they gave us the kind of government and the kind of country and the kind of Constitution that really didn't provide for that. So when a decision comes down from the judiciary, that's a separate branch of government, under Marbury versus Madison, they're entitled to interpret the law and interpret the Constitution and apply it. As an attorney, when a judge came down and said, no, I believe no. If I lost a case, I lost a case. That was the end of the discussion. What has happened with the Biden administration is they don't care what the courts say. So right now, I'm in the process of trying to figure out, how do we get another lawsuit filed to challenge the Biden administration's efforts to forgive these loans, because Biden doesn't have the legal authority to do that. But what we have, again, is we're seeing a breakdown in our society that I really did not expect that we would see. And that breakdown is coming because we have a just and moral, we do not have just and moral people in positions of power right now. And so that's what I feel like I have to spend a lot of my time doing, and what I'm trying to expose in Washington, D.C., is trying to get more people elected like you, like me, who will fight back against that. But we also are going to have to continue to fight these battles in court. Because Joe Biden said last week, yeah, the Supreme Court told me I couldn't do this, and I didn't care what they said, I'm going to do it anyway. That's not the way the rule of law is supposed to be applied. But until someone's held accountable, they're going to continue doing that. That's why this election that's coming up in November is so incredibly important. It's so important.
Next question from the audience. Harriet, where do you stand on Wyoming's mental health crisis? I haven't heard you say anything about mental health.
And I agree with you that we have some very serious mental health issues in the state of Wyoming. And when I ran for governor, I talked about that quite a bit. We've got drug and alcohol issues. We have my family members, most are educators, and I have a sister and a sister-in-law who were both resource room teachers, special ed teachers, and almost every family in our state is somehow affected by this. But this is a state issue, and I want to make sure that we understand federal issues versus state issues, because I'd like a lot of the power that's in Washington, D.C., being taken out of Washington, D.C. and brought back to the states. It's why I advocate for things like block grants, so that our governor and our Department of Health and Human Services, our various agencies, have the resources that they need to address the address the local issues that we have. You really don't want your federal representatives trying to fix this, because we're not the ones that are closest to the issue. You guys are. The money should be coming to your community, helping you to find and build those kinds of mental health resources, develop those mental health resources that are going to be better tailored to the people within your community. So I absolutely recognize that it is a crisis. We've got a lot of challenges in a state like Wyoming. We have the third highest suicide rate in the nation. We have some of the biggest challenges. Tyler is there. He's one of my staff members. He's a veteran. We have a lot of issues with our veterans. I've been meeting with them. But again, what I want to do is I want to make those resources available to the states so that the states can address those issues much more effectively than we ever could in Congress.
Congresswoman Hageman, what is the federal government and Congress doing to secure our elections?
So here's another thing I'm going to say. You do not want to federalize elections. That, again, has got to be a state issue. And you want that to stay with the states, because just imagine what would have happened if the Democrats' H.R. 1 had passed. Their H.R. 1 was to do away with all voter ID, make sure that everybody could even vote from their computer. Their H.R. 1, their biggest priority bill when they took the House 4 years ago, was to try to federalize and nationalize elections. So you want your elections at a local issue. What I have been doing is working with the RNC to make sure that they are prepared to be addressing these election integrity issues. And in fact, when I first went back to Congress last year, I went and met with the RNC for about 3.5 hours It went over the various lawsuits that they were filing, as well as the various steps that they were taking to make sure that this was going to be a free and fair election, or at least that we had a fair shot at it. About 2 months ago, I went back because I wanted to get an update on where they were now as compared to where we were a year ago on these issues. I think there's something like 56 lawsuits that have been filed by the RNC around the country. We've had some huge wins in the last 6 weeks to 2 months. One was in Pennsylvania, where the requirement of the signatures is mandatory. It's in their law that you have to have the signatures match on the ballots with whatever the signature is on file. In the 2020 election, they ignored that. The courts have now held that's absolutely mandatory. So the RNC won that lawsuit. Pennsylvania is an extremely important state. And without the cheating, I think that we can take Pennsylvania. We got two huge wins in Wisconsin just last month. They had two different issues on the ballot related to whether they could use Zuckerberg money. And that passed, that they can no longer use the Zuckerberg money, the $500 million that he threw at these various county clerks to do the Democrat get out the vote campaign. That has been stopped in Wisconsin and other states. I think almost every single lawsuit that the RNC has filed so far, they have prevailed, maybe with one or two exceptions. So they actually are getting a lot smarter, because the reality is, you're not going to get a court to overturn an election after the fact. We have to win these lawsuits and win these battles beforehand. And that's what the Democrats knew. That's what they've been fighting. But there's one other thing that a lot of people don't realize in terms of what's happened historically. In the 1980s, there was a federal district court judge in New Jersey, and he issued a consent decree that applied to the entire United States, and it prohibited Republicans from being poll watchers. What he'd had is there was a lawsuit that they had concluded that in New Jersey, there were some Republicans, I don't know what they had done, but they allegedly did something wrong. So he issued a decision that prohibited Republicans in the entire United States from being poll watchers, being in the rooms when the polls are being counted and brought in. That was lifted in about 2018. He died, but he re-upped that consent decree every 5 years until, like, it was either 2016 or 2018. That consent decree was lifted. They went back to have it reapplied, to re-up it. And it was an Obama-appointed judge that said, "What in the world are you doing? Of course I'm not going to prohibit Republicans from being poll watchers. That's a violation of the First Amendment," and on and on and on. And he lifted that prohibition and did away, abolished that consent decree. 2020 was the first time Republicans had been back as official poll watchers since the mid-1980s. And think of all the things that we saw. We were understaffed. I was a poll watcher. We were understaffed. We didn't have the right training. The RNC has close to 140,000 volunteers throughout the United States to be poll watchers and judges and other things, so that we can be a lot more confident that when there is an issue that goes wrong at a particular voting location, they're on the phone immediately and they can address it right then. So it's going to be a lot more of a rapid response, and I think a much more effective response, to try to stop the shenanigans that we've seen in the past. I think we need to be extremely vigilant, and it's a very important issue. But I really do believe that people are finally waking up and realizing how incredibly important this is, and how much the Democrats have been cheating in these elections over the years. But that consent decree killed us for almost 40 years.
Harriet, what can we do to stay informed and help you help Wyoming?
You mentioned about my newsletter. Please sign up for my newsletter so that you can get the information. I send out a newsletter every Sunday morning, and to give you a recap of what happened the previous week, what we were doing on bills, what I'm doing in districts. So this week I'm home all week. I'm not home, but I'm in Wyoming. I'm just not in Cheyenne with my husband, but I'm doing 4 town halls this week and traveling around the state. As far as the illegal alien situation, I've been down to the border 3 times now. I was in Yuba a year ago, a little over a year ago. I was in Eagle Pass, Texas over Christmas. And then I was in the Tucson sector just about 2 months ago. In the Tucson sector, 2 years ago, they had 70,000 people cross. This year, they've had 800,000 cross in that one sector. The cartels, one of the hearings we had 2 weeks ago was with the Natural Resource Committee. The cartels have moved in on our reservations. and we had two people from Montana come and testify and what the impact is having on their tribal members, the addiction, the challenges to their children, the crime, the violence that they are suffering from. We had people who refused to show up to testify because they were receiving death threats from the cartels at that particular hearing. It is a crisis. The amount of money, all of those things are just absolutely out of control. That's why this election is so incredibly important.
Next question from the audience is, Harriet, Title IX, what is going on there?
So I'm a very strong advocate for what you say because I was one of the first beneficiaries of Title IX. It was adopted in 1973, and I went into junior high in 1975. And I was at Fort Laramie, little Fort Laramie on the eastern side of the state, and we did not have a girls' basketball team or track, and we couldn't be in shop and those things. And all of us little 12 and 13-year-olds went to our principal and said, and I had a class of really good athletes. My fellow girls in that class, we were really good athletes. Some of them went on to college with sports scholarships, in fact. But I wanted to take woodworking, and I did the FFA, and I did the building of pig barns, and I was also very athletic at the time, and we got all of that. And the way that that changed my life is really indescribable. So I continued with those types of classes in high school, and I did the math, I did all of that. I love the math and English and all of those, but I really liked being in the classes that were traditionally boys' classes. And I ended up going to Casper College on a livestock judging scholarship in 1981. I was one of the first girls of the entire United States that went to college on a livestock judging scholarship because of Title IX, because I was able to do those things. And I look at what is happening now, and I'm so utterly and completely horrified at what we're putting our girls through. And it makes no sense unless you start thinking about what Marxism is and what cultural Marxism is. And it is to change the definition and to get people to believe things that aren't true and to refuse to tell the truth. We've had several hearings on this, and I have been adamant and very vocal at the federal level that I am not going to use those pronouns. I am not going to buy into this. The damage that we are doing to people in the long term, when you talk about mental health issues, this is one of them, and we're not responding correctly to it. The study that just came out of England demonstrates that the medical intervention that has been done over the last couple of years is absolutely destructive beyond imagination. But anyone with a lick of sense knew that. So I will predict something. Those Title IX rules are going to be declared illegal. It will go into the courts. I don't know who's going to end up suing over those. But the United States Supreme Court over the last 2 years especially has been pretty strong in going back to the authorizing language of what the statutes and what the agencies are entitled to do. The Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, number one, should be abolished. And number two, yes, it's the root of a lot of the evil, but it was never created until 1980, and it wasn't created by Congress. The Federal Department of Education was created by Jimmy Carter on his way out the door. It has not been authorized. It should not be. The education should be a local issue, not a federal issue. The people in Wyoming are better at education than they ever will be back in Washington, D.C. And take this from a person that the vast majority of the people in my family are educators. So Title IX will be declared to be outside of the purview of the Department of Education. They cannot change what that means. I think we will get some common sense back into this. But until we do, we have to keep fighting for our daughters. So 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you watched the hearing, I fought for 3 hours what the difference is between boys and girls. In the Judiciary Committee, we had a 3-hour hearing as to whether there were differences between boys and girls. Oh my goodness gracious. It was interesting. Yes, it was. Frustrating.
Representative Hageman, why are we paying personal income tax instead of tariffs on goods that we purchase? Isn't there a way to make that the norm here in America?
No, it's the 17th Amendment. It was President Wilson. What happened is with the 17th Amendment allowed the federal government to impose an income tax. And at the time, everybody was saying, well, what if it gets too high? We can't. And so they actually debated as to whether there should be like a 2.5% or 4%. And everybody said, there is no way in the world that the citizens of this country would ever allow the federal government to tax more than 4%. And so as a result, we don't need to put that in there. Well, they obviously, 100 years later, that was one of the most destructive amendments ever passed, was the allowing the federal government to do an income tax. But that started in the early teens of the last century. That was the 17th Amendment. The other one was the 16th Amendment that made it so that the senators were elected by the masses rather than by the states, because that took all the power away from the states. We think it's the 10th Amendment, losing the 10th Amendment. It was really the creation of the 16th Amendment that took the power away from the states. But the 17th Amendment is what imposed the federal income tax.
Representative Hageman, Maine just passed a law to get rid of the Electoral College. How would Congress be involved with that, and what can be done to stop it?
Well, it would have to go through a constitutional amendment. But that's what's frightening, is that you have people, even like Maine, who are silly enough that they don't recognize that they're the first ones disempowered. You know, it is the smaller, least populated states that at that point we no longer count. We're serfs. We're just simply vassals of the state, vassals of the federal government, if that is to go through. With our three Electoral College votes, we matter. We matter. If it is based upon the popular vote, there is no way that we can ever outvote California and New York. And it's one of the reasons why there's two other bills that I think are incredibly important, and I know we won't get them through before November, but we do have time to get them before the next census. One of them is that we have to get a bill through that you cannot count illegal aliens in redistricting, because that's why they're bringing these people in. It's not even necessarily that they can vote. It is going to skew the House of Representatives, because we are limited by the 400 to 435. So that, and then what we do need to have in terms of the federal election laws is that we should pass a federal law that to vote in a federal election, you must have ID. So that is one thing that carves it out. It doesn't take the rest away from the states. It would only apply to federal elections. But if you are going to vote in a federal election, you must have identification. Those are two bills that we're going to be working on to try to push forward. Again, it isn't happening with this administration, but we need to be ready to go in January so that if we have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, we can move some of this legislation through.
Representative Hageman, my concern is the World Health Organization. What is Congress doing about that?
So again, the World Health Organization, what Biden has been trying to do for quite some time is turn over all authority for pandemic response to the World Health Organization. So whatever the World Health Organization would say, for example, if it were COVID-19 and they said everybody has to be vaccinated, what Joe Biden wants to say is, well, then everyone has to be vaccinated. If the World Health Organization were to say everyone has to wear a mask, then Biden would say that everyone has to wear a mask. It's essentially abdicating his responsibility and authority and turning over all authority to a third world government, the World Health Organization. I would argue that there is no way something like that could go into effect under the treaty requirements. That would, in my opinion, be considered a treaty and could not be effective unless it was ratified by the U.S. Senate. There are others who would disagree with me. I think it's one of the most dangerous steps that this administration has taken, but it's very much in line with their globalist viewpoint that we should be controlled by the unelected bureaucrats in the UN and the WHO. That's why there's a couple of other committees that were set up in the 118th Congress. One of them was a subcommittee to get to the bottom of where the COVID-19 actually came from. And then another one was to evaluate our relationship with China. So those are two select committees that have been doing investigations and work. And again, I think this is where I would say is some of the effectiveness of the 118th Congress. You may be sitting there thinking, yeah, all you guys do is investigate, you never get anything done. Sometimes it's just a matter of exposing what's happening as well. I say that sunshine is the best disinfectant. We're going to be getting a report about the origins of COVID. They did come from China. It was man-made. I'm hoping that they'll go far enough to say whether it was going to be considered a biological weapon or not. I don't know if they'll go that far, but I will tell you that our intelligence, at least some of our intelligence agencies, absolutely know that that's where it came from. It needs to be exposed so it can never happen again. What I'd like to see is hold China accountable nationally and internationally for the damage they caused. But at the same time, I don't know if you remember this, but at the end of January in 2020, when this whole thing started, if you remember, China came out and said, this wasn't created by it. This virus was created by the American government. Do you remember that? Do you remember when China came out and said that? And we're all like, oh yeah, scapegoat, you're just trying to point the finger at us. Well, what do we know? Anthony Fauci. They never said it again. They said it that one time and they never said it again. And I think they were told to shut the hell up. Excuse my language, but I do. I think that they were told, yeah, you're not talking about that. Because Anthony Fauci was the one who was funding that research through EcoHealth Alliance. We are supposed to be getting the head of EcoHealth Alliance in front of our committees. The head of that Dazak guy, he is supposed to come in and testify. And I think we all have a lot of questions for him. But that is why we can never elect the WHO or the UN or any of these have the kind of power that this administration is trying to give to them. And I think I've got time for one more question, and then we're going to have to, I got to head to Lander tonight.
Congresswoman Hageman, how are we replenishing our own military resources with everything we are giving to Ukraine?
So a lot of the money, that's a very good question, and it really, a lot of the money that is part of this $95 billion is replenishing our own stockpiles, allegedly, at least that's what they tell us. That it is to replenish our own stockpiles here in the United States, because as we have been providing munitions and resources to other countries, whether it is Israel or the Ukraine, our stockpiles have been dwindling. So what we're doing is according to what we were told last week, it is that a lot of the things we will be sending them will be the materials that we have in stock right now. But this money, a lot of it is going to be going to replenishing it. That's why this bill was so strongly supported by not only the Pentagon, the military folks, the Department of Defense, but it was very strongly supported by the military industrial complex, because they're the ones that are going to come out smelling like a rose. So there's going to be an awful lot of money going to Raytheon and those kinds of companies, because it is to rebuild our own stockpiles and our own munitions, our own equipment. So that's part of it. I'll do one last question.
Congresswoman, I've heard a lot of doctors say, don't let your kids get all or any of these vaccines, but now they have to get them all in order to go to school. How do we deal with that?
You know, I think that what happened with COVID, the tragedy surrounding it is immeasurable. And it's immeasurable for our young folks, the impact on our education, the impact on our institutions. But also, there was a huge impact on our trust in our officials and in our agencies and in our institutions. And I filed the first lawsuit in the United States against Michigan State University challenging their vaccine mandate in August of 2021. I filed the very first lawsuit because I did not believe that the government had the right to do that. And I still, to this day, do not believe that they had the right to do that. And now we have all of the information coming out about what they knew and the efficacy of the vaccine, all of those things. And it has created a vaccine hesitancy unseen probably in our history. And I think that there are some goods that vaccines have done. I do. I believe that I'm the same with you. I've got the little dot on my arm for the, what was it, polio? Smallpox, yes, that's right, smallpox. I've got the little dot on my, there are some really good things that have come out of the medical establishment and the research and development and in that space. But boy, they created an awful lot of distrust, didn't they, in terms of thinking about what they've done. And then you go back to the Vaccine Immunity Act that makes it so that they are not going to ever be subject to accountability if something goes south. And I just don't think that you can force people into a situation and give immunity to the company that's forcing them into that situation. I just don't think that's fair. And I think a lot of people are questioning what we should be doing in this area entirely. And I think it's good. I don't have the answers. I don't have the answer to that one. I think it's good for all of us to be asking the questions. And I think that the people who are trying to push this, like even our own public health officials here in Wyoming, I think that they ought to be the ones standing up here in front of you and defending those decisions. I think they're the ones that should be held to account. I again want to thank you all. I know you have other things that you could be doing, but it's wonderful to have you here and to see you and to be able to engage in this conversation. So thank you for this evening.
And it's time to wrap it up here. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Just Blame Joey. And if you did, make sure to go to any of your social media accounts, look up Just Blame Joey, like and subscribe, and make sure to add the show to your automatic download feed on any of your podcasting apps. That way you'll be sure to never miss a moment of the cantankerous commentary and political entertainment.
And if you didn't enjoy the show, you can always subscribe without liking. That way you can justify all your illegitimate anger and frustration while you just blame Joey.